HeartMonitor.com and Americans for the...
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhardt, and you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We hope you'll stay with us through the hour. We have some interesting guests, and then we'll be back for Radioactivity with some very interesting guests talking about science today. We'll have both
climate change to be specific.
Climate change to be specific, and also what's happening to science textbooks and science education in our schools, what our legislators are trying to do. Also, now you don't have to wait till 9 a.m. to hear Democracy Now! You can hear it every morning at 8 a.m. on our HD3 channel, The Source. You can hear it online on WMNF.org. Listen. That's Democracy Now! Weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on WMNF's The Source and 9 a.m. on our main channel. And it's replayed on The Source at 5 p.m. every weekday afternoon.
And I'm very excited about this show, too. First, we're going to be talking to Sally Rush Wagner, and she has just written, or actually it's an anthology, of the women's suffrage movement. And I thought I knew something about women's suffrage, our history. But when I read this back on the book, I must admit I'm embarrassed. And it's really history we need to know because it is very much extant right now. But then also, I'm really excited, you know, that maybe there are a lot of climate deniers, and they're taking the chapter right out of Big Tobacco, trying to, put cast dispersions on the science and the scientists, and it also affect the teaching in the schools. But I'll tell you who gets the climate change, and they get the urgency of it. It is the kids. And so I'm really excited tomorrow with a kids strike, strike for the climate. And, you followed, I'm sure, the great little Swedish girl, Greta Thunberg, and her protesting every Friday, and she was really inspired by the students taking such actions in Parkland, and so it's just kind of become an internet of kids that they all over the world, and they're going to go out on strike tomorrow, and we are going to be talking, hopefully, to two of them, one for sure, Philiquan Charlemagne, and he is a 17-year-old in Ocala, and he's a Maine, Florida organizer, and also I'm hoping Marcella Mahalan can join us. She was in a training session, and she wasn't sure she'd be done, but we hope she will be. But,
and he's also the National Creative Director for the climate change strike.
I'm really excited. Kids get it. I'm not at all surprised. It's their world they're inheriting, and you can deny it, or you can be a modulator all you want, but they say, hey, it's urgent, and it's going to be our planet, and we want to have something to live for. So, okay, well, I'm looking at the time, and so I'm going to put on this music, and we are going to come back with Sally Rush Wagner, but let's try and make this a better world.
Skill without a long, don't count.
a perfect thing to see if we all pitched in to make a better world. And I'm telling you, the guest I have with me on the line is trying her best to make a better world. And actually, we've been lucky enough to have this woman on before. We have Sally Russ Wagner, and she was awarded one of the first doctorates in the country for work in women's studies, UC Santa Cruz. And she is the founder of one of the first level women's studies programs in the United States, CSU, Sacramento. And she currently serves as an adjunct faculty member in the Rene Crown University Honors Program, Syracuse University, and the St. John Fisher Executive Leadership Program. And she has taught women's studies courses for over 50 years. And I repeat her book, The Women's Suffrage Movement. Sally Russ Wagner, I think you have outdone yourself, or actually our foremothers, I think, have not gotten quite the credit and the amazing women they really are that we perhaps haven't acknowledged them. So kudos. This is really a fabulous book.
Oh, thank you so much, Marianne. It's great to be back on your show.
Oh, well, I always enjoy talking with you. You know, I share, but I don't have anywhere near the knowledge you do. Just great admiration for Matilda Joslyn Gage. I mean, to me, that she, you know, when you go through all of this book, I'll tell you, she's a woman that just stays consistent, and she never takes her eyes off the prize, and her prize is a decent world for all of us. And I just find that it's just amazing. And Sally, I've already decided that I'm going to have to bring you back, because there are some specific areas of this book that I really think we almost need to go in more detail than we will have time now. Namely, you know, the split with the different groups and the methodologies used and the alliances with causes that, you know, that my, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and it really is sobering to say the least. And I thought it was great at the end that you don't allow them to get off easily. You take them to task. That, you know, they had choices. That, you know, they'd worked on this for a very, very long time, and they knew what was at stake. And so expediency kind of dictated to too many the pursuit of the vote.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, Mary, as a recovering racist, I really apply the same standard to them that I apply to myself, which is, you know, if I don't know any better, maybe I get a pass. But once I know, once you know, you cannot unknow. And these suffragists knew they were abolitionists. They'd worked with African American women for years. They'd worked for the rights of African Americans. And to turn their back on them and to begin to argue, as they did toward the end of the movement, that give women the vote because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, and woman suffrage is a way to maintain white native-born supremacy. They knew better. They made the choice. They're accountable.
And, you know, going through this book, you're so aware, you know, there's almost a deification of the Constitution, if you will, and the founders of the Constitution. And we put up with the deification of Justice Scalia and these people who I think they're originalists. And, you know, I mean, in other words, and don't misunderstand me, I think it was a very noble idea. I think it was, you know, except for a very big thing, that this Constitution entrenched slavery and actually the power to white men. And I don't know if a lot of women, particularly in this country, are aware that they had a lot more rights, actually, in this country before the Constitution was passed and we became our republic. And as you point out so well, it wasn't some matter of gaining the vote, but regaining the right to vote, and not still regaining some of the rights we had before. And I think that's kind of a sobering thing to think about.
It is. I think, you know, if we begin not when white women inhabited this land. But if we go back to the origins of this land, what we find is that women had political voice on this land, indigenous women, native women, at least 1,000 years ago. The Haudenosaunee Iroquois Confederacy was founded 1,000 years ago, and those women continue to have political voice. The clan mothers choose, nominate, hold in office, and remove, if necessary, the chiefs that represent the clan on council. It's a consensus decision-making process, with everyone having a voice. That's the vision that fired, in some ways, the founding fathers. They saw democracy in action. Well, it also fired the founding mothers because they knew Haudenosaunee women. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Matilda Jocelyn Gage. Gage is given an honorary adoption into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation because she's supporting treaty rights and sovereignty. And she's standing as an ally with Native people. But these women continue to have political voice. They fired the imagination of these white women who had no political existence once they married. They were considered dead in the law. They had no right to the children. They had no right to their bodies. They had no right to any of their income. Everything that once they married became their husband's. They saw women who had authority over every aspect of their lives. And whoa, you know, all of a sudden, the idea that this could never happen, it was impossible, all of a sudden it becomes a reality. And in the colonies, yes, women voted. Property was the qualification. And if you had a certain amount of property, you were able to vote. So some women were able to vote because they had sufficient property on their own. Once the constitutions were passed in each of the states, eventually women became, well, it was illegal for women to vote. So, yes, the suffragists were saying, we're not asking for a new right. We're asking for the restitution of a right that our foremothers had.
Yeah, and I really think that, you know, that to me this is a really serious history that not just women, but all of us really need to study. Because, you know, I think it was interesting that actually with slaves, they had to figure out how to identify them, so to speak. And they really realized that the easiest thing they could compare it to was to a wife. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of sobering. But also, you know, I remember talking with you before and your great admiration for the Iroquois Confederation and their huge influence. And, you know, pretty much in our history, we're taught, you know, that, oh, well, they watched all the oppression, you know, and the kings and all of that in Europe, and that these brilliant founding fathers, you know, took what they saw was wrong there and they implemented it here. When, in fact, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were very much influenced by the Iroquois Confederacy. In fact, they had them there, you know, to give them advice during the convention. And the first thing the Iroquois man asked, where are the women?
Yeah. Well, how could you do a treaty without the women? Women were responsible for the land.
Uh-huh. But indeed, where were the women? And also with Abigail Adams, this really brilliant woman, you know, that we're kind of said, you know, kind of we read, you know, well, she says, please remember the ladies. And it's, you know, kind of an offhanded comment almost to her husband. But we find, oh, no, it was far more serious than that. Mm-hmm. You know, Abigail was really up in arms that she realized that this was going to be a terrible suppression of women. You know,
and we are determined to foment a rebellion.
And yeah.
100 years later, the suffragists knew she had said that, and they figured they were continuing it. In fact, in 1876, the centennial, they said, we have greater cause for discontent, rebellion, and revolution than did the fathers in 1776, because they were ruled by a foreign despot, but we are ruled by our fathers, our husbands, our brothers, and even our sons. They had local home rule. We have no political voice.
Yeah, and every major celebration, it's kind of amazing, the Statue of Liberty. And I know about that, and that to me is a hoot when they rented this boat. And they went there with their megaphone, you know, saying, give us the right to vote. You know, how can you possibly honor this woman in the harbor and yet you treat us as if we don't exist? I mean, they were fighting back all the time.
Yeah,
I mean,
they were.
But also, you know, also, they weren't just, like, so many of the women, well, not a lot of them, but many of them didn't want the vote because they could not support a government that had slavery and committed these wars. And so you realize, whoa, you know, these women really knew what was happening, and also that they needed economic independence. You know, we tend to think that most women, you know, were in the home and did all this work in the home, and they didn't even want to be out of the home, but they realized that being in the home was pretty much being owned with no rights. And so if they couldn't actually get money by working a job, and they got a third to a half of what the men got, if they were even able to get the job, and you realize that these same things that we're fighting for, they were fighting for a way back then.
Exactly. And part of the thing that's really sad is that as we have learned the women's suffrage movement, at least me in school, and my students at Syracuse University say it's the same thing today, what they learn about is the vote only, not that they were raising all these other issues, from violence against women, the equal pay for equal work, reproductive choice. These were all issues 150 years ago.
Yeah, and you know, and again, we're talking to Sally Rush Wagner, and the book we're talking about, The Women's Suffrage Movement, and it's readily available. It's a Penguin classic. And Sally, I think that not only is your writing just splendid, but also all the original writing you bring into it really adds a lot. But Sally, I think that the thing that really bothered me when I was going through it, you look at some of the most serious issues we have here in this country yet today. You know, how serious racism is, how serious violence is, and all the issues, and somehow you realize that there were some very important forks in the road that women were fighting for their rights, that if different decisions had been made, that you really wonder, I mean, maybe it would still be the same as it is today, but you really kind of, I kind of doubt that. I really think we could have gone in so many different areas. And it's almost like the propertied white men really had it down, the game of politics, if you will, and the game of division, to constantly put groups against each other so you can keep your power. And I thought it was kind of sad, because I'm not forgiving them either for some of the choices they made. But you realize that if the political game is rigged, so to speak, by those in power, it's very hard, actually, to penetrate that and change it.
Mm-hmm. But I think part of it is the decision about who are your allies, who are you going to really align with. And I think they made a decision late in the movement to align with white racist politicians in the South. Had they instead chosen to align with the African American men who had the vote, but it was being denied, if they had fought for the right of African American men to vote, rather than working for voter suppression laws, which they did, the Jim Crow laws, if they had worked to work with immigrant men who had the vote, instead of fighting against them and pitting themselves against them, you know, had they made different choices, different alliances, I think that history could have been different. You know, I think about the number of men that were lynched in the South, how they could have made a decision to align with Ida B. Wells and her anti-lynching work and the other women and men that were working against lynching. And instead, they kept silent when they were asked to be part of that struggle.
Well, and Sally, if you will, when one wonders how 53% of white women could have voted for Trump for president, in a way, when you read this book, you have some of the answers. I mean, in other words, it's really sad if so to speak, your class or your position is more important, you know, than, not, to me, it's not just your gender, but your integrity, your whole whole moral sense of self. And unfortunately, I find that some of those remnants, some of those same problems are still here.
I think that we follow that legacy. And this is a moment when we're celebrating the 100th anniversary. History comes to the fore in this moment. And this is a time when we can really look at the accountability of the suffrage movement for some of the problems that we continue to have today. And I call at the end of the book for a truth and reconciliation process. Because I think that until we acknowledge the truth of what the suffragists did to African-American men and women and the marginalization that we created in the process, that until we acknowledge that and take accountability for it, the healing can't happen. And how can you celebrate when the celebration is only a partial one? African-American women and men really didn't get the right to vote until the 1960s with the laws that protected them and overthrew the Jim Crow laws, the voter suppression laws. And today, we're still continuing that process. You know, so how do we dedicate ourselves to ensuring that every single citizen has the right to vote?
And Gloria Steinem writes the foreword to your book, and I think she really pretty beautifully encapsulates it when she said that it was both a miracle of shared purpose and a tragedy of division.
Mm-hmm.
And it couldn't be more true, because in a way, when you think about it, I mean, the women's rights movement was making quite good progress, and then the Civil War happens. And in a way, really, that was the second revolution, if you will, of this country. And so how to revise the Constitution? Do you write a new Constitution? You know, what do you do about all of this? And that was really a very important moment. And so how, and women, you know, want rights, not just the right to vote, but that was such a moment. And then when you see that division and one going after a constitutional amendment, the other going more for states' rights and thus justifying states' power. If they can give you the right to vote, they can take it away. And the states' rights jumped on it. You know, then it could be the men's moment, the black men's moment. And so they would have the right to vote, which then they could put all kinds of barriers on it so they didn't vote. And it was a real slugfest from then on. And I thought it was beautiful at the end of your book when you said, you know, with expediency, you give up so many of your values, you finally get the right to vote, and you don't have anything to vote for. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very, very powerful and, you know, very apt, really.
No, thank you. I think, you know, when we look at that 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment struggle, when it was necessary to change the Constitution to write slavery out of it, as slavery had been written in with a decision that 3/5 of a person is how each enslaved person would be considered. Now you had to get rid of that. Well, this was the moment when the abolitionists and the women's rights advocates came together, formed the American Equal Rights Association. Their goal was universal suffrage, the vote for everybody, women and African American men. And what Congress did was to say, no, we're just going to give it to black men. And we're going to protect them with the 14th Amendment against the states, but we're going to have to say that only men are citizens. And so all of a sudden, the Constitution recognizes gender, which it never had before, threw into question whether women were even citizens. And I think that divide-and-conquer process that the radical Republicans in Congress did in that moment was the beginning of the division. That just split the movement apart.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the time, and I know that I've got, I only have you to 10:30, and so I'm looking, and we don't have many seconds left. So, Sally Rush Wagner, I repeat, I want to bring you back because I want to spend much more time on that period, because I think we really need to know more details. It's so useful for us today. And again, the book we've been talking about is The Women's Suffrage Movement. Thank you so much for all you do, and writing this book is really appreciated. You take care.
Oh, thank you, Mary. Good to visit.
Always good to talk to you. Take care, Sally. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And again, we were talking to Dr. Sally Rush Wagner, and it's really an extraordinary book. And what I really love about it, she's got many of the original writings, and it's really fascinating to hear Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Josh and Glades and some of the other really brilliant women, you know, really tell it like it is. And they have scintillating minds. And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And I think that actually we're going to, I was going to wait just a few minutes, but as I understand it, one of our guests is already on the phone. Is that right, Arlene?
That is correct. It's Marcella
Mahalan. Yes. Okay. Well, then, I think, and I don't think that our other guest is quite available yet, but I'm going to bring Marcella in. Fela Kwan is going to be at 10:35, but I'm going to put on Marcella right now. And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And this is about the Kids Strike Friday. And so let me put on whatchamandouble.
And this is a global strike about climate change.
Hi, Marcella. Can you hear me?
Yes, Mary, I can.
Oh, great. Thanks so much for calling in. I know you had a training session this morning, and I know how busy you are, and you're part.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you. You're part of the Sunrise Movement, and, you know, I've had you on before because when the new Congress was sworn in, you were on the job right then, so to speak, and the Green New Deal is very important to all of you young people. And so tell me, Marcella, you're a student at the University of Florida, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Go Gators.
Oh. and what are you majoring in?
I'm double majoring in political science and sustainability studies.
Okay, great. And so
yeah.
I know how active you have been, you know, with the Green New Deal. And are you, I have read, because I keep following your website. I love your logo that just as you know, the sun will rise tomorrow. I know that's a beautiful analogy, really, because, you know, right now, I mean, the sun in a way has always been the center of our universe, if you will. And it's really important that we don't get too much heat that's trapped there for us. But yeah, I mean, because you know, it is, but it is our nurture, so to speak. And so I know that a lot of you are going around the country trying to explain a little bit about what the Green New Deal is about, as you understand it, and what some of your concerns are. And are you involved in that or not?
So Sunrise recently launched, like you were saying, the Green New Deal tour, and it's going to be a national tour where we're hitting, I think it's 15 different cities. Because we want to take the message of the Green New Deal to all corners of the country and really share with the public what something like the Green New Deal could mean for their lives and how it could improve their lives personally. And I personally am not involved with the planning of that because I am in school full time now. But I will be graduating in the summer and plugging back into Sunrise Movement in a more full time capacity.
And I'm curious because I'm really excited that, you know, that I'm disappointed when we've been so aware of global change and how much it's human driven really for a long enough time that it's kind of sad that we haven't done more about it. But I'm really excited that you young people really get it. And so tell me, what were some of the factors that made you aware of the real dangers of climate change, frankly, to your future?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in South Florida, and when I was in high school, my family moved to Fort Lauderdale, which is right on the beach, and we lived in an apartment building that was two blocks from the beach. And when I lived there, I wasn't really aware of global climate change or sea level rise or terms like that. I just knew that dealing with hurricanes had been a kind of semi-regular part of my life since I was a kid. And this weird thing started happening where there would be the street in front of my house would flood sometimes even when it wasn't raining. And it was like this weird situation where people who lived there who had no idea about sea level rise or weren't particularly environmentalists were kind of forced to become experts on the ocean's tidal patterns because it affected their day-to-day lives. And businesses would have to put up sandbags and sometimes my parents would have to park their cars on higher levels so that the car wouldn't flood. And I that was just like something that my family dealt with. And then I went to college and I started learning about global warming and sea level rise. And it made me kind of put my personal experiences in a global context. And I realized that the hurricanes and flooding that I had experienced were really just warning signs of what was yet to come for coastal South Florida and for so many other parts of the world that are vulnerable to climate change. And so it was like a weird situation where my personal experiences were then heightened by my academic career. And then Trump was elected, which was a really radicalizing experience for myself and I think for young people across the country as well. And I just realized that like my generation's future was really on the line and our national politics was taking this really drastic turn for the worse. And I also just felt like neither political party had really taken climate change as seriously as it needed to be. And I felt really called to take action on my values and the causes that I cared about. So I joined Sunrise and have been involved in the climate movement ever since.
And tell me, Marcella, did you find in high school, in your science classes, were you studying about climate change? Were you studying about the kind of factors that go into some of the problems you were seeing? Or did you have to kind of pick that up in college or what?
To be honest with you, I don't really remember learning about climate change specifically in high school. I may have learned, I think I did learn about greenhouse gas emissions and the heating effect that they can have, but I don't really remember ever having a teacher that like really sounded the alarm on the fact that we are like on the brinks of climate catastrophe that could end civilization as we know it. And it's kind of frustrating because I grew up in South Florida, like I said, and that area really has so much at stake in this crisis. And I was upset that it took me like 19 years of my life and then going to college to learn that just like how much is on the line.
Well, that's pretty amazing because unfortunately, you know, I'm concerned that really it's taken us this long to really get on the stick, so to speak. And I think the recent IPCC, the Intergovernmental Policy on Climate Change, really kind of stuck a bee in a lot of people's bonnets. But I'm upset that the adults really haven't quite responded as much as they need to. And I think right now has also joined us on the line is Feliquan Charlemagne. And Feliquan, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, great, great. And Feliquan, actually, I think is the main Florida organizer for the Kids Strike for Climate tomorrow, March 15th. And I believe that Feliquan is a student in Ocala High School, and he is the National Creative Director for the strike tomorrow. And so, Feliquan Charlemagne, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah, that's perfect, yeah.
Oh, great. Listen, welcome so much to the show. And I've been talking to a colleague of yours, Marcella Mulholland, and she is a University of Florida student who is going to be also involved in the strike. So, Feliquan, tell me, you're originally from St. Thomas, is that right?
Yes, in the Virgin Islands, yeah.
And why did your family leave?
Well, there was plenty of reasons, really, why we left, but one of the main reasons is that, you know, for my entire life, St. Thomas has been taking a hit due to the climate crisis, and so from rising tides to natural disasters like hurricanes, tropical storms, it just kept getting worse and worse. It kind of became imperative that we left and moved here to Florida. And so that's really one of the main reasons I'm involved in the you know, youth climate strike and really this movement, because it's affected my life so much already. And just like Marcella, I live here in Florida, and really it's not a sustainable solution. It's not enough to just move from country to country or city to city, state to state, because the climate crisis will follow, and Florida is the state that will be most affected by climate change and the first affected by climate change.
Yeah, and you said that, you know, people can't keep moving from place to place. In fact, climate refugees are becoming a very sizable group of refugees. And in fact, in the Syrian crisis that we're all looking at, the terrible drought they had drove the peasants off the farms and into the cities, which totally traumatized and made the situation much worse. And so even our military is quite aware of the dangers of climate change to our national security. And I noticed, Feliquan, that actually you were very involved. Was it last year that a group of students in Tallahassee supported the Parkland students, you know, with a terrible massacre down there of those students? And so you are a pretty active young man.
Yeah, I was involved in March for Life. I created a chapter with a good friend of mine named Pujan Patel. I created an Ocala chapter, and we were in the Gainesville die-in protest to protest gun violence.
And Greta Thunberg, who is really one of the originators, you might say, by her actions, a Swedish young woman who, with the climate meetings in Davos, said, this is ridiculous. And she was very much affected by the students in Parkland when they said, we are not going to take this anymore. We're going to do something about this. And so I find this interconnectedness that all of you students, particularly all over the world, really see the things and you think, I'm not going to sit back and ask somebody to do this for me. I'm going to have to take it on myself. And tell me, with something as daunting almost as climate change, why did you decide that there are lots of things we can do about this?
Well, I just see that in the past, you know, from like the civil rights movement, even more recent things like, you know, getting marriage equality, every single movement you see in really the history of this country, it's huge grassroots movements that you can use to make big structural change. And so this is really a crisis that, first of all, needs to be solved. There's no alternative. And so things like the Green New Deal are policies that I think that the youth can push forward, and things that will work out, and things that can really save my future.
Oh, Farlaquin, you just really said something important, that if you ask any historian, it's not individuals who really make changes. I mean, it is, but it's the movement. And
exactly.
And to me, I see this climate change movement that particularly you young people are really leading, that to me, it's one of the most thrilling things I've seen in a long time. And I'm just thrilled because I'm going to be having a guest next hour, and John Cook, and he is a scientist, and he's been fighting deniers for quite a while. And I think he sums it up beautifully. And he says, I can sum it up in 10 words about climate change. You know, it's real, it's bad, it's us, and scientists say we can do something about it.
That's
and to me, that's about as concise as you can get it. And so what do you have planned for tomorrow?
Okay, so in a bunch of cities in Florida, even more than are in my reach, because, you know, people saw the movement and they rose up and started creating strikes of their own. So personally, with Youth Climate Strike and with Florida Climate Strike, you know, we've had about 5 strikes, but there's even more than that. And so what we expect is thousands of people all over Florida really demanding climate action from our legislators. And, you know, there's a lot of demands that our organization has. We want, first of all, the government to pay attention to the IPCC report. We want science-based action. We want a Green New Deal, no new fossil fuel infrastructure, and so on and so forth, really, to first of all, meet the goal of not going over the 1.5 degrees Celsius increase that will cause a lot of devastating effects.
And are you getting much feedback from the teachers that you're going to skip school to go do this protest, or how do the teachers feel about this?
Well, I know a lot of people have had kind of a negative feedback from it. I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly who. I think it was like the prime minister of some country, like, tweeted, like, this is such a stupid idea. Why are these kids just skipping school, like, you guys, or whatever, whatever. And I remember, like, Greta Thunberg, like, replied and said, like, your tweet belongs in a museum or something like that. So, a lot of people are definitely saying, like, not to do this, but as we see with things like, for example, March for Our Lives, the walkouts that really stormed our country, it doesn't matter what they tell us. I think that one day of school, or even a couple of days of school, that does not equate to really how grandiose the climate crisis will become if we don't solve it. And so I personally just don't care what these people have to say that have done nothing to solve the problem so far. You know, we're the ones who are writing the narrative. We're the ones who push back, so they don't really get to tell us what to do.
And Marcella, you're also still with us here. And now you're in college, so you're in a little different situation. But how are you, and how is the Sunrise Movement, because I know you're totally supporting this youth climate strike tomorrow, how are you intending to spend the day?
Yeah, so I've been helping organize the U.S. climate strike, so We're having a strike on campus Friday at noon, and we're working in cohesion with other high schoolers in the area who are also planning a strike in Gainesville that'll be happening that afternoon. So this is a really great moment where we're seeing solidarity across students in high school and college as well. And I really think that when we all show up together, our power will not be able to be ignored, hopefully. And my professors on campus have been extremely supportive, and we have several coming to speak and who've been spreading the word with their students. And this is actually a really exciting week for activism on campus because the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is also here, and there's a huge rally today for farm workers, and tomorrow we have the strike. So it's really, there's a lot of good energy on campus right now.
And tell me, Marcella and Farlequin, do you see this as a teaching moment, you know, in other words, for your parents and older people, or to kind of get them to say, hey, you know, this is really serious, it's urgent, we have to do something, you can't just say, meh, or how are you approaching this?
Well, yeah, I think that when adults see the youth taking such action, I think it is really a teaching moment because, you know, we're kind of characterized as this generation. Like, all we care about is our phones and social media and whatnot. And so when you see us getting really passionate about something like this and really sacrificing all our time to plan these protests and plan these rallies and try to make change, I think it really is a teaching moment, not only for the adults, but really for the other youth, our peers.
And you know, Bill McKibben, the founder of 350, who has been a tremendous supporter of the battle for, you know, against climate change, and he was saying how much he supports the walkout tomorrow and how important it is to, so to speak, learn on the streets and not just what you learn in the school. And I thought he made a very interesting analogy that Martin Luther King actually, in 63 in Selma, actually called on the school children, you know, to go out on strike. And, you know, the parents were really worried and upset. This really bothered them. And he said, no. He said, this is the most important lesson. He said that not only for them, but for all of us. And, you know, I think there is something. And I know in the Warsaw Ghetto, too, it was the young people. It was the children who really were perhaps the most courageous. And sometimes I think it takes the passion, but also the kind of clarity that you young people really show in getting it and just how serious it is. And both of you have had experience, you in St. Thomas, but also Marcella just talking down in Fort Lauderdale, you know, seeing this with just high tide, so to speak, flooding. And what do you think are some of the main things you need to do to overcome the reluctance to actually do some serious measures to change this?
So I think the main obstacle to meaningful climate action in the United States is not public support, because if you look at opinion polling, the public is on our side when it comes to a Green New Deal and climate action more broadly. The problem is that so many of our politicians are bought out by fossil fuel executives and billionaires, and the role that fossil fuel money has played in our democracy has been extremely corrupting. And you see this on other issues, including gun violence, where public opinion polls show the overwhelming majority of Americans supporting very basic gun safety regulations. But Congress has failed to act on this, and it's clear that it's because of the corrupting influence of NRA money. So we at Sunrise are really focused on getting fossil fuel money out of politics and also mobilizing the people across the country who already are on our side on this issue and making sure that they are vocal and enthusiastic supporters, because we think that people power really has the potential to change the political landscape. And we're also focused on the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, which works to elect candidates who have taken this pledge, where they basically commit to prioritizing the health of people and planet over campaign donations from fossil fuel billionaires. So we're hoping, and we saw this in the midterm elections where we elected so many progressive champions like Ocasio-Cortez, who did take the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge and are now really shaking things up in D.C. And there's a movement of people across the country behind these politicians who are supporting them and supporting things like the Green New Deal.
So you're going to really hold their feet to the fire. No messing around. And that's great. That's really great. And how about you, Fela Kwan? How are you thinking what we need to do to change this situation?
No, I totally agree with what Marcella just said. It really is all about money. That's really always what it's been about. And so, like, for example, I can't think of a single congresswoman who doesn't take, you know, corporate PAC money, fossil fuel money and whatnot, someone who doesn't have corporate hands inside of their pockets who does not support the Green New Deal. Not a single one can I think of. And then beyond that, what Marcella said about public support is true. The Green New Deal is extremely popular everywhere. When it was first being brought up, all the Republicans were naysaying and being like, oh, this is not going to play well in the Midwest, and this is not going to play well here and there, and whatnot, blah, 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 so on and so forth. But it's extremely popular policy, and we even see this with, for example, the original New Deal, FDR's New Deal. A couple of years after we started seeing the effects of it, Democrats held that House for about 40 years. That's just the type of, it's not only good policy, but it's really good politics as well. Saving ourselves from the climate crisis, creating millions of jobs in the process. It really is just about, you know, getting politicians supported, not about the people.
And tell me, are either of you at all interested maybe in some time running for a position in politics? Are you thinking about that at all?
Possibly. I'm pretty young. I'm just 17. But I have thought about it.
You're still working on going to college, right?
Yeah.
And do you have any plans in that direction yet? Where you'd like to go to school yet?
No, I'm not completely sure. I've thought about maybe like Howard University or maybe somewhere in California, but I'm not completely sure about that yet.
And have you decided, like, you know, Marcella is going in both political science, but also, you know, understanding sustainability. What major would you be looking at? Science or?
I really like economics, so I might go into economics. And then we haven't really talked about it much, but, you know, I'm the creative director for, you know, Youth Climate Strike. So I'm really into marketing as well. So maybe like a double major in marketing and economics.
Well, I think you're both really, I'm so thrilled. I mean, you young people really give us all hope. And I thought it was really cute with Theda when she said that, I think it was Merkel that said, well, it's really important, you know, that we give these young people hope. And she said, I don't want your hope. She said, I want you to do something. We don't need your hope. I mean, Greta doesn't mess around. She'll say it like it is. And I think that that is a really wonderful model. And so our Marcella Fela Kwan, because we've kind of gone through this quickly, any final thoughts that you want to say about tomorrow and your hopes for the future?
Not really.
I would just say if there's any young people listening right now who also feel overwhelmed and like a great deal of grief about the kind of trajectory that our planet is going in right now, I would encourage you all to get involved, whether it's with the Strike Tomorrow or with Sunrise Movement or other organizations in your local community, because there are other young people out there who share your pain and who are also outraged at how politicians have failed to act on this issue. And I'd love to be in this movement alongside you. And there's a great deal of hope to be found in taking part in the movement we're building.
Well, I hope the weather is terrific tomorrow, and I'm hoping in our area, too, others will join and just make their
feelings. One last thing.
We'll take it seriously. So, okay, I really want to thank both of you. I know how busy both of you are. Fela Kwan Charlemagne, who is the creative director, national creative director for the Youth Strike for Climate, and Marcella Mulholland, which is who's with the Sunrise Movement. Thank you both so much. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Mary.
You take care. Bye-bye, and good luck tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
And aren't they impressive, Arlene?
Oh, it's great. To-
oh, well, let me put you on mic.
It's great to share young voices and to see the action. In many ways, they're outshining us. They don't sit around and plan forever in order to do something. They plan it carefully. That's obvious. But they also do it. And that's what we have to learn from these young people, and we have to support them and join them. And so it's really exciting to have them on the show.
And, you know, we've mentioned Theda Thunberg a lot on the show. And I got a little piece there that when she was addressing the group in Davos. And so let's give a little, I think you'll want to hear her.
Greta Thunberg. I am 15 years old and I'm from Sweden. I speak on behalf of Climate Justice Now. Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to. But to do that, we have to speak clearly, no matter how uncomfortable that may be. You only speak of green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet. Our civilization is being sacrificed for the opportunity of a very small number of people to continue making enormous amounts of money. Our biosphere is being sacrificed so that rich people in countries like mine can live in luxury. It is the sufferings of the many which pay for the luxuries of the few. The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there still was time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Until you start focusing on what needs to be done rather than what is politically possible, there is no hope. We cannot solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to focus on equity. And if solutions within this system are so impossible to find, then maybe we should change the system itself. We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past and you will ignore us again. You have run out of excuses and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people. Thank you.
That's pretty powerful words, and out of the mouths of babes does come the wisdom, and we can only be thankful that the kids are getting them, and it's their future, it is their world, and we, frankly, have done a pretty poor job of manning this ship in this time, and I really feel embarrassed that we're giving them this kind of a world. But as John Cook says, it's climate change, it's real, it's bad, it's us, and science, you can do something about it. So, okay, go ahead, Arlene, go right ahead.
And we hope you'll stay tuned for Radioactivity when we talk to John Cook and to Dr. Brad Hoag. And so those will be related to what we've just been talking about, and excellent topics. Also, Midpoint at noon today, show host Lynn Marvin Dingfelder will be talking about art and activism in honor of Women's History Month.
Oh, great.
They will have three dynamic female artists in studio, Jan Roberts, Victoria Jorgensen, Mary Rose Holmes, and Tyler Martinilich. So stay tuned right through the day, and keep your dial on WMNF 88.5 FM.
Okay, people, let's try. You can all do something. We're going to try and make this a better world. And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Keep it tuned here all day, people.